Harris, Mr. Stewart.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mark Stewart, appointed counsel for Mr. Harris, this criminal appeal from the Northern District of Illinois. In May of 2003, as a result of a narcotics operation or surveillance on West Ohio in Chicago, Chicago police officers observed what they believed to be several drug transactions apparently involving Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris and Mr. Pettis were arrested, and shortly after that, Mr. Harris allegedly indicated that he had a gun and would be willing to provide the gun to law enforcement in exchange for them letting him go. In June of 2004, Mr. Harris was named in a second superseding indictment, which really only corrected a serial number and changed caliber to millimeters for the firearm, but otherwise was the same as the first superseding indictment. He was charged with being a felon in possession and in a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute approximately 1.5 grams of cocaine. In July, Mr. Harris went to trial, was found guilty on the felon in possession charge and not guilty on the drug conspiracy charge. And in September of 2004, was sentenced to 120 months, special assessment of $100, and was not ordered to pay a fine or restitution. The first item or issue would like to address concerns the district court's denial of Mr. Harris's post-trial motions, both for new trial and for judgment of acquittal. Those motions were made at the end of the government's case and also at the end of trial, and then were submitted following a jury verdict in written form, both as to Rule 29 on July 8th and as to Rule 33 on July 14th. District Court denied those motions in August of 2004. The principal issue in both of those that we address on appeal is the insufficiency of evidence. And as noted in our brief, we acknowledge that this is, in a way, in a very real way, an uphill battle for any defendant, allowing for the various iterations that this court has made concerning that battle, from heavy burden to virtually insurmountable. We acknowledge that certainly in our brief and here this morning. But what we have here, we submit, is nothing more than evidence that Mr. Harris knew there was a gun at the South California address, the one room that he shared with his mother. And that's all that the government's evidence showed, was knowledge of a gun. There was no evidence, we submit, that Mr. Harris had the intent and the ability or the power or the authority to exercise any control over the firearm. The federal government, vis-a-vis the Chicago Police Department, for whatever reasons, did not avail itself of a couple of aspects that would have perhaps been a home run, if you'll pardon the vernacular, and that is the weapon was not handled properly to preserve them, to preserve it for fingerprints. So we have no fingerprint evidence indicating.
Well, what's your notion? Is that it was the mother's gun or what?
No, that consistent with the mother's testimony, it was part of property left over from previous tenants, and that Mr. Harris knew.
Well, then it became their property, didn't it, or what? Very strange.
Well, according to...
what do you do if you find someone else's property? I suppose you either, if you don't return it, you're asserting control over it, aren't you? I mean,
that may well be, except in this instance...
So is it the mother's gun?
I believe the record is clear that it was the mother who found the weapon, and that Mr. Harris's knowledge of the weapon came by virtue of her telling him about it.
So the mother finds a gun in a shoe?
In a shoe, Your Honor.
And it just sits there? It just remains indefinitely in the shoe?
Well, that's her testimony, yes. Shortly before telling her son...
Pretty implausible, isn't it?
Your Honor, it's her testimony. And I recognize the jury, first of all, in the district court, is in the position to assess credibility, but that was her testimony. And our point in part is that the government did nothing to take this beyond the realm of the situation we find here. As I mentioned, the gun was not handled in any manner so as to be fingerprinted. The shoe that the gun was found in was alleged to be...
You're arguing is irrational for the jury to assume that he possessed this gun?
Arguing that there was insufficient evidence that Mr. Harris had the intent and the ability to control. That when left with a notion of...
Understand that.
That when left with a notion of constructive possession, the government did not carry its burden of proof.
I don't know. That doesn't sound right.
So what about his statement? Didn't he make a statement after his arrest?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. And the
statement about how he bought the gun for $50? That was before the jury, wasn't it?
It was, Your Honor.
Because the district court didn't suppress that statement.
Neither suppressed the statement nor the firearm, yes, Your Honor. The ATF agent who was called in, apparently, by virtue of the fact that Chicago police were of a mind that there was someone in that neighborhood trafficking in firearms, and we acknowledge Mr. Harris's background is such that if you'll, again, pardon the expression, he probably has a lot of street savvy and realized that telling Chicago police officers that there's a gun at South California wasn't going to get him very far. And as argued by counsel at trial, and we submit, the story about Mr. Harris buying the gun from a female by the name of Poochie was concocted by Mr. Harris in order to have a sizzle to sell the steak, if you will. A weapon, as it turns out, that was manufactured apparently sometime between 1914 and 1928 in Spain, at least according to the ATF testimony.
Well, if you make a false inculpatory, or you make an inculpatory statement and you deny it later, you're pretty much behind the eight ball. I understand how you can think the jury was irrational. Jury has to compare two different possibilities. One is that he possessed the gun. The other is that this cock and bull story is true. So how can you fault a jury for picking the more plausible alternative?
Your Honor, it's our position that that the other more is the more plausible, that in fact Mr. Harris...
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, people don't just find a gun and they stare at it and they leave it in the shoe. Were they not wearing the shoe or something? Is it their shoe? Whose shoe?
That's part of it. There was no evidence that it was his shoe.
What is it? Whose shoe is it? Is it a third person? These people left their shoes behind with a gun?
That is my recollection.
His tenants?
That was my recollection and understanding of Mrs. Harris' testimony. Yes, Your Honor. The final point has to do with the...
The jury was discriminating enough that they acquitted him of the conspiracy charge, didn't they?
Yes, Your Honor. They did acquit him of count
so
two.
They got it right only half the time?
And Your Honor, and in keeping with Judge Posner's questions, it may well be that the jury did the rational thing. As to the motion to suppress, in brief, would like to address part of the government's argument regarding the motion to suppress, and that is that the argument was forfeited, and if not forfeited, was waived. We submit, Your Honor, that it's not forfeited, that the argument made in the brief was actually an expansion or extension of part of the evidence and argument presented to the district court, and that does not constitute a forfeiture. And secondly, this was not a perfunctory argument and therefore was not a waiver, and submit that the court erred in denying the motion to suppress. In sum, we would ask that you reverse Mr. Harris's conviction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stewart. Ms. Bonamici?
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. As Judge Posner, you've already emphasized, the district court ruling in this on the motion to suppress rested on factual findings that should only be reversed if the defendant is able to establish that no rational jury could reach the conclusion reached by the jury in this case based on the evidence it had before it. That is clearly not the case in this case. With respect to both the motion to suppress and the ultimate judgment or conviction of the defendant, the evidence was pretty clear that the gun we were talking about was located in the defendant's residence. The defendant admitted, as Judge Williams, as you pointed out, the defendant admitted in a signed statement that he told Officer Thalen about a gun I had at home. So clearly he admitted both that the California residence was his residence and the gun was his. He went on to admit the circumstances under which he obtained the gun. And all of that evidence was before the jury, in addition to the evidence that included the officer's testimony about both the defendant's admissions and about where they found the gun, the location of which matched precisely the location provided by the defendant, including the fact that it was a blue shoe. And Judge Posner, in answer to your question, it was a man's shoe. We at least know that, not a woman's shoe. So at least it would not
just
have...
Just one shoe or a pair of shoes?
Your Honor, I don't know the evidence with respect to that question, but clearly the shoe that the gun was in could not have fit his mother. All of these facts taken together clearly indicated that the defendant knew of the gun, and also that the defendant intended and had the ability to exercise dominion and control over the gun. In fact, he represented that very fact to the officers when he told them that if they went to the residence, his mother would give them the gun. So it's very clear that the jury had before it more than sufficient evidence to support its conviction, or the conviction of the defendant. With respect to focusing now on the suppression issue, the defendant has not come close to meeting the applicable standard. The recovery, he argues in his brief that he was not involved in the drug sales. Obviously, the jury went along with the question of whether there was ultimately at trial, went along with his position, or at least found that there was insufficient evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that he was involved in the drug sales. But the court looked at the testimony of the officers, Officer Thalen in particular, and compared it to the testimony of the defendant, made a credibility finding that was clearly reasonable, and I think you could even reasonably argue that it would have been unreasonable to accept the defendant's story on the motion to suppress. As far as the drinking goes, the officers directly contradicted the defendant's testimony that he had been drinking or that he gave the impression that he was drunk, and the officers directly contradicted the defendant's suggestion that it was the officer's idea rather than his idea to provide a gun in the hopes of obtaining lenient treatment. With respect to the question of whether the defendant concocted the story, there's no evidence in the record to support that beyond the arguments of counsel. In fact, at the motion to suppress, the defendant testified with respect to, or actually admitted that he had purchased the gun for $50, and there was no evidence regarding no explanation for why he told the story that he told the police at the time of his arrest, except for his desire for lenience, which you can make out just from looking at the sworn statement. So that really isn't a valid basis. In sum, because the defendant was fairly convicted based on evidence, all of which was properly admitted at trial, the government does request that the court affirm both the conviction and the sentence of the defendant in this case.
Hey, thank you, Ms. Bonamici. Mr. Stewart, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? Okay, well, we thank your efforts.